There are a variety of ways to express, to explore the Dharma. We have been engaged in a number of ways in these past few days here together. So one, of course, is the direct listening to the teachings quite wisely and appropriately. It is often said that in the supportive and enabling conditions of the act and the process of listening, it is one of the most suitable vehicles for insight, for discovery, for realization. That there is something of immense value when women and men come together in this atmosphere of interest and receptivity. And it can happen for all of us that something which is said, which is shared, which is communicated, as it were, touches the spot. It lands well for us. And truth, which is, trust, what we are deeply interested in, can never be in the form of a construct. One can't make truth into a special language, because then it becomes an ideology. The truth is that which touches us, which wakes us up, which makes contributes to seeing clearly, which opens our mind, opens our heart up. So truth is something which interrupts the old. It interrupts the event. And nobody, no religion, philosopher, no thinker, no science, has truth. Nobody has it or got it. But one of the vehicles for the meeting with truth sometimes is in the listening. But there are other forms also. One of those, of course, is inquiry. Two people looking into things together, seeing what happens and is explored through that, and something may emerge which touches us, which helps us to see clearly. It's a moment of truth. There's also our meditations and our reflections. Another kind of receptivity. Another process of the inner listening taking place. And then there's an access in some aspect of our life, of our personality, of the way things are, of the way things are becoming. This gets clear to us in a way which they were not before. And truth has the function for human beings of freeing us up. Truth also, as we will do in a few moments, the teachings rather can be explored through questions and answers. But can come through the poem. Truth can be revealed equally in fiction as in non-fiction. It's not unusual for you and I to read some beautiful literature, to read a beautiful poem that's come from a place inside another human being. And those words, those lines, that sentence, that communication, that theme touches us. It helps us in our own life. It nourishes us. It feeds us. Truth has touched us. And that's why I say no organization, no religion, no philosophy of science. It can only have a collection of ideas, an assembly of thought, a construct of the view, but we're interested in more than that. So this period of time, it's rather a long introduction, this period of time is a question and answer period with one or two health warnings from the beginning. The one is, your question and my answer may bear no relationship. Regard it if it does as an extraordinary coincidental event. Yeah. So sometimes a person asks myself a question, and I respond for a minute or two, or 2 or 3 minutes or so, and you may well think and well understand that when I finish and invite another, the thought may arise in you, but what you said, Christopher, bore absolutely no relationship to what I was asking. There, so it may not. There, so if you're willing to put up with that, there, and some questions I can respond to. There, and if I can't, that's out of my area or field, then I'll definitely let you know. With regard to the dialogue, the question and answer form here, that as much as possible, we just touch on the areas which are genuinely of interest to us, but it's very open. You can absolutely ask anything you wish to ask. And in the exploration and the dynamic of that, it might include, from the talks, things that I have said. It might include from your meditations, areas you reflected upon, issues that have arisen for you. And of course, the world of our institutions can be included in that. Our religious institutions, our scientific institutions, philosophical ones, secular ones, environmental, global ones, all can be part of the dialogue here. And with the questions and the responses, that sometimes when we listen, as was said from the very first day, what the interest is in that there's the view, and the view is connected with whatever it might be connected with. Remember, it's the view. There's no one here who is claiming absoluteness about it. It is the view. The view is being shared. The view is being shared fearlessly. The view is being shared as openly as possible. And it's as much as possible to keep in some attunement with that. But essentially, most importantly, you feel completely free to say or to ask anything that you wish to ask. Your good voice may end up on the recorder. Yet again, there. So anyone who has anything you would like to ask about this, and the small point, of course, is that tomorrow morning, Leela and Iran and I will speak a little bit about the daily life, about the transition from here to there, and some of those questions we'll endeavour to cover. Anyone has anything that you would like to ask about this evening? Yes, please, sir. And your good voice would carry to those who are way behind you. Yes.
I wanted to ask about time and rebirth.
Oh, it could be one of those evenings. So the good man wants to ask about time and rebirth. Go on, ask.
Well, I'm quite preoccupied in my daily life about time, age, etc.
Right.
And I heard that the Buddha had something to say about it. I mean, about how life goes on, about death and rebirth. And I wanted to hear your aspect.
All right. Okay.
Of that.
So, remember the health warning. A little bit from the Buddha as revealed in the text. A little bit from Christopher's understanding from path and experience. With regard to the first, generally speaking, and you're quite right with your comment, generally speaking, the assumption of rebirth is more or less, in the Buddhist text, taken for granted. A general assumption. It's a view. It's one of the unprovables. It's a view. And the example or the illustration or the metaphor which is used is like the waves in the ocean. So you and I and us, here we are in this life. And there are forces moving. And the forces move and, as it were, gives rise to the wave in the ocean. Wave, a 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 wave. According to the force. And as we go deeper into life, the formation of the wave of as I, me, and myself, the identification, the grasping onto it gets much less. We begin to have a sense of the ocean. We begin to, as it were, have a sense of the taste of the water. And so, generally speaking, of the four views which are available to our species, the one which one most primarily hears in the Eastern tradition of the Buddha is the one of rebirth. There are three alternatives to it, all unprovable. One of them is the scientific materialistic one. There is one life, this is it, you are born once, you are die, and when we die, it is absolute, total extinction, finished. Baskadam Bodhi, as they say, all over. Everything else is to be refuted. One view. Another view is the religious view, born of three religions of the world only, and that is the three religions which has it here. And apologies. And those religions have told us what happens to us after we die. Determines whether we go to the kingdom of heaven for eternity, whether we go to hell, or there's some other kind of limbo state which the Roman Catholic Church thought, because they couldn't make up their mind about it. And there's an eternity for one or the other. Or a judgment day, which all happens together. This is a view, unprovable again, just as much as the others. And the fourth one, is the one of a kind of disembodied spirit. So when we die, consciousness leaves the body, and we're in a kind of bodiless condition, disembodied state. The Buddha has said, with regard to this, on a number of occasions he has taken a very provisional view, very importantly, because it's an unprovable. He says, if there is rebirth, if it's the provisional, if there is rebirth, we will experience the impact and the consequences and the fruit of our actions, if there is. And if there isn't rebirth, a provisional, if there isn't rebirth, then we will still experience the impact and the influence of how we live. The effect will still happen to us in a variety of ways. In the Dharma teachings, there is a keenness to end rebirth. What that means is not a preoccupation about what will happen to me in my so-called next life or whatever. But it's the ending of the rebirth of the ego. That is the rebirth we are finishing with. It's the rebirth of the dissolution of clinging, of possessiveness, of the poisons of the mind, which get reborn and reborn and coming up again and again because we haven't really attended to them. There is, in fact, in the Buddhist text, no word rebirth. It does not appear in the Buddhist text. It is not in the teaching of the Buddha. The word actually isn't used. And the word which is used is re-becoming. So what happens, there is life, the movement of our life unfolding, and then things become. And they arise. And they will arise again until we've understood them till we've really looked into them. And so the sense of the liberation for a human being is to end the rebirth in this very life of the problematic mind. Question? Yes, please.
Can you...
good lady has a... And yes, sir. Yes, please. I didn't quite hear a catch.
You would speak about forgiveness.
Forgiveness, yes. Question is, would I speak about forgiveness?
Yes. I'm not sure about the word, the exact word, but yeah. When you hold anger or hatred or
yes.
frustration to somebody,
yes.
and you find it difficult to forgive,
yes.
How do I look at the meditative way?
Yeah, good question. All right. The question is, sometimes we're experiencing a lot of anger or a lot of hate, a lot of blame and negativity and fault-finding towards another or others, towards an individual or a group, or whoever it might be. And how do we come to some forgiveness? How do we find forgiveness? And how can we explore that with meditation process? Very important question. And it's a question which arises a great deal from the hearts of thoughtful and caring people. But I do want to make a few points with regard to this. When there's anger, the anger is directed towards another or others, or towards ourselves sometimes. And the force of the anger, the dark, blame, rage, or reactivity that comes in the emergence of it, in the rebirth of it, the re-becoming of it, there may be a voice, the precious and beautiful voice outside of the anger, which says, I don't want to be angry with this person. I'm burning up inside over this. And the voice is saying, can I find a forgiveness which is outside of the anger? Different from, I have to say, it is an enormous challenge for the emotional life. It's a huge one. I've had some one-to-ones with you over the days here with some of you. To go and make that transformation from anger to forgiveness, it's a huge task for the heart to make. And it seems to me that sometimes we are letting go of the anger there. And the very construct, the emotional construct of the anger, is coming from other places. Hurt. Disappointment. The perception of memory. What she or he or they did to me or did to us. And in the view and the memory which goes along with it, when the anger begins to drop away, it doesn't immediately reveal any forgiveness. And what can be emerging inside of us is confusion, a feeling inside of some despair, of helplessness, of disappointment, of thoughts arising, I should be angry, I have a right to be angry, even though the anger as a force has dropped away, and we're still dealing with it. Sometimes for days, weeks, months, years, events have gone by, and still we're dealing with it. The Buddha has addressed this. And there has to be some middle ground. And he has spoken, and a number of you will know this, of the extraordinary importance in life of equanimity. That means being very steady and very even-hearted, even-minded to the event or events. And I think sometimes, in some situations in life, we are asking too much of the heart to make a shift from anger to forgiveness. I don't think it's an absolute necessity. Can I find a place of non-anger, non-hatred, non-blame, and to find that place inside of us, somehow or other, I have to understand this person. I have to understand what are the causes and conditions that makes a certain heart, mind, and body and speech do what they do, say what they say, or not do what was really needed to be done. Either way can bring the anger from us. And we're trying to find, without idealizing forgiveness, which is always the danger with it, to find enough steadiness. I need to understand this person. So the Dharma teachings do not place a great use on the word forgiveness. It's hard to find the use of this word in the text. There is a recognition of how difficult it is in the face of anger. But can we find enough steadiness, which enough equanimity, to be able to attend to what needs to be attended, to understand somebody? And it may be out of that will come authentic compassion, will come a forgiveness there. And the teaching said, and then I had a lovely meeting with someone earlier. Teachings have said the near enemy of a compassionate love, of forgiveness, the near enemy of it is pity. And we have to go deeper than the pity. We haven't gone deep enough into that with it. So sometimes there's anger, then there's hurt and disappointment and despair and confusion and not knowing how to deal with it. And all that is indicating some collapse of the anger. One might be feeling some more wounds and hurt inside because anger is an escape from those feelings. We may have to go through all of that. We may start feeling pity. Pity for ourselves, pity for the other person, pity for them, pity for us. And still have to find a depth of equanimity there. But just to be careful of not putting too high a value on forgiveness. And my small reminder of this is, you know, one of my favorite rabbis, that man Jesus from Nazareth from a couple of thousand years ago. And he's on the cross there, you know, he gets nailed. I mean, these days, Dharma teachers only get nailed with words, but in those days, the Romans nailed to the cross. He didn't say, after the Romans had nailed him, he didn't say, "I forgive you. Father, Abba, forgive them. Don't ask me to, it's too much." Wise man, Jesus. Good rabbi. Alright, next question. Yes, please.
Regarding this equanimity.
Yes.
My question revolves actually on the opposite. Not on anger.
So the question is around equanimity, not around anger.
Around happiness.
Happiness.
More than that, pardon? Around blissful states.
Blissful states.
Mm-hmm. Say, while performing metta meditation,
yes,
feeling bursting out with love,
yes,
and with happiness and unity towards all.
Very nice.
Should one still keep total equanimity,
yeah,
toward this experience as well?
Yeah,
and just relate to it as a guest.
Mm-hmm.
Breathe it in, breathe it out, and or stay with it?
This is slightly Buddhist monk response, being an ex-Buddhist monk. All right. So the question is, sometimes in the meditation, as you pointed out, it's lovely to hear, that lots of bliss and happiness and love begins to flow out through the soul, through the heart, through the being, and there's a certain delight and probably a certain high which goes along with it. Sometimes it's rather similar, those feelings, to falling in love. You know, the cells and all the happiness there. But the benefit in meditation is that you don't need someone for it. And there'll probably be less disappointment later as well. But anyway. All right. Forgive me, all those of you who are in love. All of us. So, in the release, it is a practice, and I appreciate the concern there. It isn't easy to find a way in which we keep grounded, the equanimity aspect of this, keep rather focused, because we're actually interested in the happiness of the deep, in a way, rather than the happiness of the high. And sometimes the strong language is used. Sometimes the happiness of the high, getting very, very high, is called, this is what we used to hear when we were monks, upakilesa, a very big defilement. Strong language. Do you understand the word defilement? Impurity. To be impure. And strong language is used. And the reason in the monasteries the strong language get used, because in the discipline of the meditation monasteries, day in and day out, day in and day out, of the Vipassana monastery, that there can be this release into the high, consciousness really gets lifted up, really, really lifted up. But if we get out of touch with being grounded, that high will bring a one almighty crash. One almighty crash. Because we've got disconnected from the ground. And when that crash comes, it can come in all sorts of ways, and sometimes very painful ways. So it is the exploration of enjoying the happiness and the love which can be released from the being, really to enjoy that, and allowing it to move through, being willing to drop method and technique and form and all of that. Being willing to drop trying to be concentrated, drop all that. Just allow the being to experience it, and the skill is, at the same time, feeling grounded with it. So the sense of groundedness would be with the deep, without suppressing the happiness and the love. And it's a skill, but it's a very beautiful one. And there won't be the backlash later on. It's a good question, thank you. Yes, anyone, please. Yes.
Sometimes I find myself in an environment in which some people around me.
Yes.
Find it hard to accept others as well.
Yes.
And any fear of either happiness or
fear of
simple happiness. Or
happiness, yeah.
Yeah, simple joy of being.
Yes.
React and cause some cynical reaction.
Yes.
And How can you keep yourself captured?
Yeah.
And being with yourself.
Yeah.
Facing these
reactions. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I appreciate along with that, showing and generating compassion towards the sinful person.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good question. It is a pity, and I do agree, that natural and spontaneous happiness can trigger a view of cynicism from others. That sometimes when people's own lives are stressed out, when the level of happiness is very, very low, because of all the fears, the insecurities, the clinging, the attachment, a life of, as it were, accumulated problems. When another is not living in all of those shadows, and is perfectly, but there's a certain natural sense of happiness and well-being which goes on. It's quite important, it's important for you, that as much as possible, one stays true to it. We stay true to happiness. And not by the voices who are negative, who put blame, who are cynical, etc. And we have to be with our natural happiness, the guardian angel of what comes out of our mouth. And in the vulnerability of our human situation, it's terribly easy to be happy and someone just says something to us. You know, the unkind mark, the put down. And easily that a reaction can come to it. Happy and then a reaction there. That's why the happiness, a bit connected with the previous question, if it feels deep, we can genuinely trust in it and just stay steady. And we have to remember that we were born with two ears and a hell of a lot of space between them. And we need it to use that space. So when someone is laying a number on us, you know, for being happy, just, you know, let it travel. right through, so it doesn't land anywhere. You know, I remember a year or two ago, I was actually going through the Seder with a good friend whose mother is a psychotherapist, and we were sitting in the car and just talking a little bit, and then she said to me, "The trouble with you, Christopher, is you're pathologically happy." Well, you know, the world is full of Christophers. There'd be no therapists left, you know, whatever. So sometimes you just have to stay true to it. It's precious and it's beautiful. And I read in the English newspaper a year or two ago that on an average day 50 years ago, that's in mid-1950s, people laughed and smiled on average 18 minutes per day. That was in the mid-1950s. Yeah. And now it's down to 6 minutes. There's been a gradual diminishing of the amount of happiness in the country. So if it continues on like this, you know, in 20 or 30 years of time, we'll be saying, "Do you remember those people in the old days? They used to be happy." And now it's all over. We're all in one collective misery, etc. So we actually need happiness. It's creative, it's fun, it's good. We need to enjoy and to really feel that and to live it and experience it and share it. Happiness is precious for our species. Yes, anyone please? Yes.
have you? We speak a lot here about all the wars in Israel, and
yes.
all the hunger, and
yeah.
add to that all the other reasons that people suffer.
Yes, as well. Yes.
How do you keep the happiness when
yeah.
you're
yeah.
with your eyes open?
Mm.
How do you keep the happiness and not get overcome by the sadness from all these things yeah. while still keeping your eyes open while you're seeing
it? Yeah.
Trying to help.
Yeah. There are a few things here with Otis which helped me, you know, to answer this personally. I had the privilege of traveling a lot around this world, and therefore moving in different societies and different cultures and different environments. And from being with those very privileged and rich, and often obviously one scratches it deeper. There may be the outward sign of success, but maybe a lot more going on behind all of that, which is very difficult. And of course, with the very, very poor, as well in Bihar, with war situations and so forth. For myself here, there are a few things which I find just vitally important. And one of them is to keep the inner life as steady as possible amidst this world that we live in. You know, as steady as a mountain in a hurricane. So to keep the steadiness there. And the second is, if there's too much grasping or holding onto the situation in the present, it will tend to extend itself into the future. And I kind of both at the global level, if I may say, and at the personal level or at the regional level, try to be myself as careful as possible in my meditations and outside of them to watch the arising of the thought with regard to the future. And if there's disappointment in the present, and it extends itself, it will run into the future. Things are bad, things are getting worse. And that train of thought is the line of thought for despair. And if I live in hope, which sometimes can be to put a kind of warm colour around events, the risk is with the hope that the hope isn't fulfilled and the disappointment comes. So I'm very watchful of the way, for myself, my own life, in the life of my friends and loved ones and the Sangha, in the life of peoples, to be very, very watchful of what the thought is with regard to the future. Because disappointment and hope, fear and loss kind of easily come in that respect. and talking of wars, when just recently I was giving a talk in Britain on why are we English, why are we so violent? And one of the leading Russian sociologists looked at the last 1,000 years of history, going back to 1,000 years, the last 1,000 years. And the country which has been most at war in the last 1,000 years is England. On average, it's been at war for 56 years out of every 100. And it is still at war. It's been at war consistently in most of my lifetime. It is at war at the present time on the people of Afghanistan, on the people of Iraq. And it always has the rationale for this. And when that happens, of course, with that, the politicians are wondering why there is so much violence on the streets, why there is so much violence in the home. It's all part of the violence. And you have to find in all of that, to look very carefully and look very, 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 very deeply. It's a great challenge for all of us as an individual on this earth. And as a collective, you know, we're people together there. And to find enough steadiness to stay true to happiness there, sometimes to stay really true to equanimity, the uncertainties of the future of our whole planet, our whole species and life on Earth there. And there's some, I find for myself, some kind of authenticity about it. I just find the ways to stay steady and not be afraid to speak. But if we are not going to be afraid to speak, we have to be prepared to take the heat that comes back. And to speak up in this world, then be prepared to take the heat that goes along with it. You can't take the heat, shut up. Yes, thank you. Anyone, please. Yes, at the back, yes.
Positive thinking. The fine line between staying true to yourself and being a hypocrite about it. Towards yourself and towards others.
Right, well, could you just expand a little bit on the fine line?
Myself and others, many times speaking in positive ways, even though the truth is that you're not feeling positive at the moment. Or, you know, I don't know,
yeah.
Friend's cousin just passed away. How are you? I'm doing great. You know, when it serves you and when you're lying to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. One has to be a little watchful with this. It's important that it is addressed. A little watchful in the viewing of ourselves, the label or the description that is given, as the example that you just gave. Someone we know dies and has an impact. And someone asks us a question and says, I'm feeling great. And if the label comes in to ourselves or elsewhere of being a hypocrite, the hardness of the label, or using it with regard to another, the hardness of the label may inhibit us from looking at the dynamic, because we put a label on ourselves, we put a label on others, and Umberly suggests just to be watchful of the label and to look at and explore how are we going to find ways, which isn't easy, it's a practice, to be as clear as we are as possible, to really acknowledge what we're feeling there and not be interested in trying to mask with positive feeling. I don't think the masking with positive feeling in the short or the long term is helpful. And what happens in the short term is there's covering up, as you point out, which is going on. And in the short term, we're putting out this mask of everything's fine, everything's good, everything's okay there. But inside, deeper inside, there's much more which is going on. And I think honesty and clarity is far more effective than staying true to something than the power of positive thinking. I'm not a keen advocate of positive thinking. I'm a keen advocate of clear thinking. I'm a keen advocate of watching what thought says. I'm a keen advocate of seeing the view that emerges from the thought. I'm a keen advocate of seeing, is this beneficial or harmful? That I feel is more important than just ideology, a popular one, of creating positive thinking. Possibility for disappointment is high. Yes, anyone, please. Come to you in a minute. Yes, please.
I'm not quoting what Buddha said, but more or less what I read. That Buddha said that we are what we think. Again,
we
maybe
what
I'm
we
not
what?
Quoting it right.
I just didn't catch, I'm sorry. What did the Buddha say?
That we are what we think. But
he didn't. No, no,
this
never.
Is what I'm confused again, because today I understand that we are not what we think.
Yeah. So, I'll explore a little here, expand a little here. A few years ago, Random House, it's a book publisher, said to me, "Oh, Christopher, would you do a book of one quote per day of the Buddha? You know, 365 days, one quote." And so there are rather a lot of discourses on the Buddha. So I spent about 3 months reading through, putting little dots on the quotes that I liked and made it, what do you, about 500, edited them down. Here you are, and I think it sold 3 copies. And, and my mother bought them all. So I see many, many times. She got a discount. I see many, many times. Many, many times. So many things are attributed to what the Buddha said. Many, many things. I have a Dharma e-news and in a recent issue, I wrote down, basically just 2 or 3 hours, 40 things that the Buddha is supposed to have said and never said. It's never in the text. And one of them, you are what you think. It's the common one there. My God, I don't know about you, but I'm one of the things that makes me very happy is knowing that I am not what I think. God, it's just such a relief. Happiness can come through many ways, and I think this is one of the best. So just to remind you, you are not what you think. And you are not who you think you are, etc. Who you are is much closer to you than your thoughts. So, as in the teachings and the instructions that you received from Alila and Iran, the regular reminders, in Dharma language, of going from self to non-self. Instead of, I am what I think I am. Instead of that view, we have this wonderful capacity, some of you have experienced well and clearly in your meditations, of being able to see thought come, stay, and pass. If that's who you are, then you come, and you stay, and then, God, you pass, you're dead. You're dead as a dodo, as they say. So we have the capacity to be aware of the arising of the thoughts. They come and go. And to see them come and pass. And the analogy which I often use, do you remember years ago in the old communist era of Russia, you had these guys, you know, the Politburo, you know, except the president, prime minister, in Moscow on May Day. I remember I don't know if they still did. They're the deadly serious people, you know. Can't imagine them ever smiling in their entire life. And they've got a hat on, and you've got this huge army parade, you know, soldiers and trucks and tanks and weapons. And they're standing there like this, feeling very important. standing there like this, worrying about the level of their cholesterol. And they're just standing there for ages. And it goes by, and then the soldiers, you know. And I think we should treat our thoughts in the same way.
Thank you.
All right, anyone, so you're going to ask. Or... Yes, sir.
I don't have exactly the form of a question.
No.
I am interested, though, in perhaps skillful way of inquiry.
Yes.
About the feeling of being misunderstood.
Yeah. Yeah. The question is, and the most really important question, this one. The feeling of being misunderstood by others. And it's one of those areas of life of discussion and sharing and exploration and human communication where this feeling of being misunderstood for what we say, what we do, what we don't say, or what we do really can have such an impact on us. It can lend itself to the feeling of being hurt or betrayed. You can feel upset and angry. The person doesn't really comprehend us. The person walks out on us. Or whatever it might be, the person starts giving us a hard time. And there are many consequences to the feeling of being misunderstood. Yeah. We can't live, unfortunately, in a world where there is a consistency of being understood. To understand, which means it's nothing to do with figuring out, to understand is the issue stands under us. It's not a problem on top of us. And sometimes, when we, as I mentioned, when we feel misunderstood, we have one important refuge with this. But we have to be very clear and honest. Very honest. No misleading or cheating inwardly. We have to be clear with regard to our intention. And stay true and honest, strictly true and strictly honest to the intention. And if we look back at that event or event, and the heart says, my intention was loving. The intention was not to cause harm. The intention was not to cause conflict and confusion. We may still be misunderstood, but we've listened to what the intention was, and we have to stay true to it, and therefore keep rather centered inside of ourselves. And if we do, we won't be in this position of trying to justify ourselves. And sometimes, if we lose touch with the inner, and we feel misunderstood, and the self reacts, it will usually show itself in three ways, showing that we haven't been able to handle being misunderstood. And the three ways it will show itself is, we'll argue back, which shows we haven't understood the person. We'll attack back. You're going on about me, but what about you? Boom, boom. Then there's two misunderstandings going on. We're like, sometimes like ships as human beings passing in the night, and sometimes we collide in the night with two ships, and both sink. The other is, sometimes we get very defensive, trying to explain. We may be misunderstood, and our efforts to try to explain so the person understands us, sometimes the person does not want to understand. The person wishes to keep the view of not understanding us. They wish to hold to that, so that what we say No matter what we say, no matter how sensitively, how clearly, how lucidly, how respectfully, the person can still say, I just don't understand you. All right. And the other response that sometimes we have is that we withdraw. When I'm not misunderstood, well, that's it, I'm off, I'm out. Don't contact me. I'm taking my mobile phone number. I'm emigrating. So either we attack back, we get defensive, or we withdraw. And this is the self arising, the I and the my arising. And say, if the person is right, sometimes the person understands us better than we understand ourselves. They can see through our act. We can be telling them this, that, and the other. And they listen. And they say, actually, the real motive is something else. We're being manipulative. We want something. We've got some other intention in mind. The honesty which is required from us, we might initially feel I'm misunderstood, but if the person is clear and is seeing us clearly, then it's our task and our responsibility to apologize. You're right. There was another agenda going on for me. You're right. Thank you. Sometimes with ourselves, it's like the hand to our face. Sometimes it's so close to us, we just can't see it very, very clearly. And sometimes people have a little bit more space around. And they can see us very clearly. Well, you need to take notice. We shouldn't always think we understand ourselves and others don't understand us. This can be one big ego trip. I understand myself, but you don't understand me. Not always like that. Not always. But if we're being true with the intention, then we look, yes, I'm being true, stay true to it. And sometimes myself, and you may experience the same, sometimes somebody launches into an incredible attack. I've had plenty of them over the years there. And I just have a sense that no matter what I say, it's not going to make one bit of difference. Yes? So I don't want to avoid it, and I don't want to get into defensiveness, I don't want to get into attacking the other person. But sometimes I will say, can we have this exchange in a day or two's time, when the heat has gone? Can we speak it about at that time? So there's no running away from, and sometimes the immediate conditions are not appropriate. And therefore we say, oh no, tomorrow or the day after, etc. And sometimes in that I've noticed that it's a completely different quality of communication. And sometimes for the person, it was all heat. 2 days later, they completely forgot about it. Anyone else, please? Yes.
I wanted to ask about morality.
Morality.
And
yes.
the first precept of not taking life, and it with regards to vegetarianism and eat and using animal products. Yeah. The Buddhist view about it, I understand that the Buddha himself, he did eat meat and etc. So I was wondering what the view would be.
Right. The question is on being vegetarian, eating meat. Buddha's view my book. in looking back in 2,500 years ago, and even today in India, so through the long generations of the homeless ones engaged in some kind of spiritual search and exploration, even in India today, nearly all are still vegetarian. Probably 30-40% of the population of India, I mean 300-400 million people, is still vegetarian. And of course a field which is growing rice and lentils and vegetables can provide an immeasurable amount more food than some cows in a field, or animals in a field. But the Buddha took a rather flexible view, I have to say, about the eating of meat. And I doubt very much whether the wandering sadhus of India ate any meat. I doubt it. Not even today. Not done today. There's no history of this. There's no statement which actually states the Buddha was eating meat. I think the essential view that was taken was it's more important what comes out of our mouth than what goes in it. I think that's basically the bottom line of it. Having said that, I and some others here as well, refuse to eat anything with a face. So, I'm not just referring to cannibalism here, you know. That means birds, animals, and fish. I refuse to eat anything which has a face. That's my bottom line. And there are others here as well. And as we see, just in the days of being here, that how nutritious and beneficial a vegetarian diet is. And animals, birds and fish, if they could speak to us directly, for those of us who are vegetarian, would be, you know, extremely grateful. It's no fun being eaten. And the other aspect of it is as well, like in Britain, because I only know the figures, over 600 million animals and birds are eaten every year in Britain. Kept in these appalling factories. The chickens, there'd be four chickens on a piece of paper this size. Terrible condition. Thousands of them in these chicken factories. And all the various consequences of all of that. So there's one act from the act of health for some of us. Not for myself. For others, it's the morality of supporting of life. And some, even though life depends on life and all the web of life that goes on, some of us just draw the line and say no. And it isn't easy, because in some situations, one goes home and there on the table is the backside of a cow, you know, or the leg of a chicken, or some poor fish with its eyes staring out into the sea. And the others, members of the family, are happily sinking their teeth into all of it. Yeah. And one says, well, I don't like to make a fuss. And so one joins. But sometimes, for some people, it's a view, remember, view. For some people, for some of us, we prefer to say thank you, but no thank you. We may well, coming back to the good question previously, we may well be misunderstood. We may well be suddenly, you're a bit weird, what's wrong with us? All of that may come to us just through taking one simple decision as an adult. For some of us, that's part of our practice. Still, having said that, what comes out of our mouth? That's what we really have to give attention to. Couple more questions. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, please. Yes.
I wanted to ask, what can be done if someone is in suffer?
Someone is
in suffer.
In suffering, yes.
And he doesn't want any help. And what I know, sometimes people, until big crisis rising, doesn't want to get any help.
Yeah.
If something can be done before,
The question is, someone is suffering a lot. And the person is refusing all help, just doesn't want any help. It is a very, very difficult situation. Very, very difficult. And the Buddha was asked this question, exactly the same question. And just as you're asking the question there, I record an incident on a retreat in Bodh Gaya some years ago. The analogy and the fact met together. So it was the sitting from around 9 to 9:30. We were just sitting in the same number, 100 of us, in the meditation hall in the Thai monastery in Bodh Gaya. And then suddenly we could hear somebody shouting out, "Help! Help!" And where was that? And it was coming from, as it were, the bowels of the earth. It was coming from deep down. What was that? "Help! Help!" And I got off the throne and went outside into the grounds of the monastery, and I could hear this, "Help! Help!" And I walked over. And on the right-hand side of the monastery, in the garden there was a well. And one of the women, she was doing her slow walking meditation in the dark. And she said to herself, "I would be so mindful that when I get to my toe goes over the edge of the well, and now I've reached the edge, and I'll turn round, and I very slowly turn round and go back." Like, I see you do lovely walking meditations yourself. And so she's doing a very slow, conscious, and it's rather powerful walking meditation. But she got a little unmindful and forgot that when her foot got to the edge, the other foot went over, and down she went. Down this very, the most people in this room, right down to the well. Fortunately, the water, plenty of depth in the water. She was lucky. And so she's down there, "Help! Help!" So I walked around, and then I haven't lost the story, I promise, but what's the question? So I came round, and I got a couple of people who came, and we got a torch. And so she's down there at the bottom of the well, feeling a little bit sorry for herself. a bit wet there. And we threw the rope down there, and then some very narrow little rungs of stairs, and she got them and with the rope, and we got her out. How does this relate to your good question? There was all the good intention of us showing the light, pointing out where these narrow steps were, throwing the rope down so she'd have something else to hold around her waist in case she slipped off the stairs, And between us and the rope and the stairs, we got her out. In order for that event to take place, the good yogi down there in the darkness of the well had to have the intention to take hold of the rope. Without it, we're helpless. This is the difficulty. Somewhere in the depth of the human being, though there may be tremendous hard voices, I didn't need any help. There's nothing you can do. Nobody can do anything for me. And all the reactiveness. And somewhere it takes an enormous skill with no guarantee and a huge amount of love and patience. Can we pick up the first little glimmer of intention and see gently, gently, gently? And sometimes that may have to be through not addressing the suffering, but talking about the non-suffering, talking about something completely different, something nothing related to the event. And possibly, something may emerge from it, and the person takes hold of the rope. But it is, I think, for all of us, one of the most difficult challenges that we have. Because the person's intention is rather critical. But if we listen and we love and we listen and we talk and we're patient, we may just pick it up somewhere. And then just ways small steps forward are taken. Last question today. Yes.
I have two questions. Please do. The first one is, do you decorate love?
Do I what with it?
Decorate love.
Decorate.
Categorize.
Go on.
Decorate it. Love to women, love to friends, love to people, love to father or mother. Is there any difference?
Well, I hope so. I can't imagine things I might say or do with my girlfriend I would want to with my mother. So, but the categorization, I'm a little, you know, categorization feels a little enclosed. But the expressions of love and the responses of it are countless in number. Countless. And that's the extraordinary thing. But that also can take place towards the same person as well. You know, sometimes in a relationship of love, sometimes it's a man in the relationship to love, it's the man to the woman. And sometimes in the relationship of love to the same person, it's the son to the mother. Sometimes in the relationship of love, it's the two friends. Sometimes in the relationship of the love, it's the brother and the sister. Sometimes in the relationship of love, it's the teacher and the student. You know, the dynamics of love, this is between two people, can constantly be changing. And I think we just need not to fix ourselves into any particular category in any way. And I say that also equally with regard to parents. That without parents, yes, there's the respect of the father and the mother. And as the Buddha commented, the first two gods in our life are our mother and our father. And sometimes it's more one god than the other, etc. And but also we are adults as well, and so sometimes from the place of the adult needs to communicate to the adult, and therefore the role and the identity of mother and father is much softer. Some people here are a parent, and sometimes children have more wisdom and understanding than we do, and therefore the role can be reversed. We have something really to learn from our children, whatever the age is there. So the flexibility and fluidity with love is very, very precious. And here with the networks and the Sangha, Iran and I were just speaking a little bit about this early on. You know, there's the role of the Dharma teacher. It's a role, and it's a chance to share love and loving kindness and friendship together. And tomorrow, wonderfully, the hat of the Dharma teacher is off. Oh, hallelujah. And then one doesn't, for me anyway, I can't then just the kind of withdraw into some little shell. You know, some teachers do their role and they're off. And then the role changes. And there's a chance for myself to see some friends here and to have a cafe latte and to hang out and etc. And so it's a recognition of the wisdom and the appropriateness of the roles for the expressions of love. And it's a fluidity, I feel, that goes along with it as well. So sometimes you and I and others, we have some authority in life. It's precious and beautiful. But let's make sure that the love is shining through the authority. And when it shines through the authority, it is really for the welfare and benefit. When it doesn't, we'll become little fascists. We'll become authoritarian, controlling, and we'll set up our own little fascist kingdom. Because we've excluded the love from the authority. So we're just exploring ways that love and authority really can work together. It's a great challenge for all of us. Enough. Let's have a couple of quiet minutes, sorry. Thank you. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings live with insight. May all beings live with a liberating wisdom. Thank you very much, one and all, for the questions. Beautiful and deep and very important questions. And in keeping our questioning alive, we pay a great tribute to ourselves, a great tribute to each other. The tremendous faculty that we have is to question. And it's a great voice for one and all.